are back on the Cannabis Corner. My name is Lucas Barfield, and I am joined by my co-host, Uncle Dig. How's it going today, Uncle Dig?
Man, it is growing great. It's a little chilly outside, but I am getting in the Xmas spirit, as they say.
Yeah, me too, man. We have some Xmas stuff going on around here in South Tacoma, and I just wanted to share with the audience that we were live broadcasting with one of our radio stations that we are played on here in Tacoma, KTQA 95.3 LPFM, and we're also played on Radio Tacoma, their sister station right here in Tacoma, and those are sort of our home base where we do all our show, and we were out at the Santa Parade Dig doing a live broadcast. I got to play some pre-1960s Christmas vinyl. It was really neat. I was playing Let It Snow while it was snowing, Dig.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, it was really nice. We were live on the air, and I have to share with the audience because it actually made the national news. Right when we were done, they were like, okay, the band is coming, the parade is coming. We started taking the gear down. I was unhooking my mixer and my turntables and everything, and the band was coming. It was right about to be where we were at, and Dig, somebody who turned out to be drunk, went through the barricades up on 54th Street right here in South Tacoma, took a right, and was stopped by parade volunteers, some security guards, about 50 yards from plowing into the marching band. It was crazy.
That is nuts.
Yeah, it is pretty wild, and I'm still pretty giddy about it. I'm still a little uncomfortable with it. Definitely was using some cannabis after that, some vapes to get myself calmed down. We were really kind of not freaking out because it was hard to kind of figure out what was happening. Took the police about 5 minutes to get down there. Still haven't really figured out what's going on with all that. But thank you to those volunteers for stopping that guy. And I hope he's okay too. But as a reminder, folks, don't be out there drinking and driving. And matter of fact, don't be out there dabbing and driving. But just be safe out on the roads this holiday season, y'all.
Yeah, don't try to run down any Santa Claus parades.
I just wanted to let everybody know that we have uploaded season 3 of the Cannabis Corner to our YouTube channel. If you search the Cannabis Corner over on YouTube, you can find our show. The picture for our show is a right angle with a cannabis leaf in the corner. That's how you can know that it is the right show, the Cannabis Corner. And you can subscribe to the show over at our blog, thecannabiscorner840.blogspot.com. And then finally, I'd just like to mention that coming up, please stay tuned because we have Gregory Foster, who is the owner and operator of a website called The Cannabis Observer, who does a lot of observation and reporting on the Washington State cannabis system, and will be here to update us on what's coming up in the Washington State Legislature when it comes to cannabis. So stay tuned for that. And now, let's check the news.
This is a Cannabis Sativa Special Report.
And our first story, we're going to look over at the cannabis system that is coming out in New York State. And Dig, I have to tell you, it doesn't seem like people running these cannabis programs are learning the lessons of other states on how to do this. Because New York State, they're having some of the same problems that everybody else has been having. Now, I have to give it to them. They did come out and say that everybody who is getting the licenses first, that they were going to be social equity applicants. We've covered that a bit on the show here. Yeah. Everybody knows what that is. So that was really great. So that the numbers are, they had 28 licenses given out to businesses and individuals and 8 nonprofits.
Okay.
But the problem is just like all the other states, and you know, New York City's one of the biggest cities in the world. There's a lot of underground cannabis that was already there. And a lot of those people are saying, well, we want in on this too. We've been doing this for 30 years in our basement, and they're opening up shops, they're doing deliveries, and there's this emerging gray market in New York State that's causing them a lot of problems.
Yeah, and as long as – and like – so while New York's cannabis tax is at 13%, it's a high tax rate, people forget that Oregon and Washington both have higher tax rate. Oregon, I think, is at 17%. And what is Washington's tax rate at the point of sale for cannabis?
It's 37%, the highest in the nation.
No wonder. Okay, that's wow, I forgot. Okay, that's disgusting. Anyway, so as long as you have high tax rates, There's the gray and black markets are always going to be a budget-friendly alternative, right? Because they're not having to pay that overhead. Also, home grow in New York, while it's legal for medical caregivers, and I don't know how what their plant cards counts are, but it's not legal for recreational use until 18 months after the first dispensaries open per New York's legalization laws. Mm. So what's going to happen is they're trying to make sure that home growers can't compete with the licensed market. And what I've told people is that while you will have gray market operators, true home growers that are growing for themselves are not going to make any kind of dent in the legal market. So you need to stop worrying about them.
No, it's just small plants. I mean, it's a small plant count. You have to, we've talked about this before, you have to get up to 30, 40, 50, 60, even more plants to actually try to even kind of make money or anything. But there's folks already out there already operating. They already have a strain out there that was, I mean, it was like 7-8 years ago I saw it, New York Sour Diesel. So they're already breeding and everything. So it's New York City and New York State has a big cannabis market. Matter of fact, we talked to one of our guests. I was just putting this up on YouTube. Matter of fact, season 3 is now up on YouTube. And one of our guests, Rick Barbero, was talking about how they were shipping big bales of tie sticks over to New York City in the 1970s. So, you know, it's a big city there, New York State. New York just needs to learn the lesson of the other state and open up these licenses and try to bring on more people into the cannabis industry instead of blocking everybody out. Because what is happening is the legislature is starting to notice this, these gray market operators, and they're starting to roll out bills saying, oh, guess it's time to bring in the police to shut them all down.
Oh, yeah. And I was seeing articles recently in New York after out of like big busts of like, you know, gray market cannabis. And it's really unfortunate because we should be doing our best to integrate these people into the legal system or just leave them alone.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what the pesticide regimen testing is or in a lot of states, but in a lot of states, they're not testing the cannabis and stuff to a degree that's making it much safer for consumption. So really the government is skimming off the top without enforcing any regulations that make the plant safer to consume. So really the government is rent seeking without providing any value. So why the market would comply with that when there's no incentive financially, it makes perfect sense. So until the state lower their taxes or increase their value added to the process, there's no point in participating in a coercive system that is just stealing money from operators without value added. And I'm sorry, the police are not value added. No cannabis grower wants their money going to the police.
So now our next story is another legalization story, and it's moving over to Ireland. And Ireland is known as a conservative country, but they are slowly kind of stepping into the cannabis arena, kind of like other countries and other states have in the past. They introduced a bill, and like they were saying in the article, there's really no reason anybody thinks that this is going to pass. But it is kind of starting to get the discussion going. And how much did they say they were going to decriminalize there in Ireland, Dick?
Yeah, and it's important that people realize it's decriminalization. This is not legalization. A gentleman named Gino Kenny, I'm sorry if I'm not saying that right, an Irish politician, introduced this into one of their legislative bodies. They're calling it the marijuana legalization bill, but that's not what it does. It decriminalizes the possession of 2.5 grams of cannabis resin or 7 grams of cannabis flower, which is the ye old quarter ounce for anyone from the old game. So that's what they're decriminalizing. Anything more than that is still going to be a law violation. So I understand that people think, you know, this isn't very much, it isn't fast enough, but it's important for us to realize that Ireland is a very conservative, you know, nightmare Catholic country, So you have to remember that they're going to be, and most of Europe is probably 20 years behind the U.S. Lucas and I were talking about this. He was saying that most of Europe is decriminalizing rather than legalizing.
Yeah, some of the other countries have taken this same step. Luxembourg, I know Belgium has medical cannabis. You know, even Amsterdam, cannabis is not actually legal. It's just sort of decriminalized, like looked the other way kind of thing going on. But some other countries have actually started on these very small little steps just to see what happens. And I'm guessing when they say 2.5 grams of cannabis resin, they mean hash or some. I doubt they mean something like BHO, but maybe they do. But
nah, they mean the resin you scrape off your bong, man.
That's a lot of resin, 2.5 grams.
So gross.
Admittedly, I have had 2.5 grams of resin around before, so I don't mean to talk about the pipe scrapers. It's been quite a while before since I scraped a pipe, but I have too. Definitely scraped pipes before. Matter of fact, kind of budgeted that into your cannabis budget every month. And it usually wasn't because we didn't have any money, it was just because you couldn't find any, you know?
Yeah.
It's because it was a dry spell, and you never can tell, though, Dig, because the way the cannabis market's going right now, and I think we're going to jump on this next show a little deeper. Whew, cannabis industry is not having that big a great year as far as profits and some of these big MSOs and some of the stuff going on. So
you think we might be looking at a legal dry spell one of these days?
Oh, I don't know about that, but okay, I hope we don't have to get back to the pipe scraping days. But you just never can tell the way some of the politics are going right now, and there's starting to be a little blowback against cannabis too, and our guest on later on the show will be talking about that. But
okay,
yeah, some real interesting stuff coming out of Ireland. Now let's look back here in the United States at Pennsylvania. Now Pennsylvania only has medical cannabis. I think they've tried to get the adult use going a couple times, but they too are, I mean, they oftentimes go blue in the presidential elections, but they too are sort of known as more of a conservative area of the country, seems like to me, in a lot of ways, especially on these type of topics, because they have not been able to pass the adult use, but they do have medical. They're doing this really cool thing, and we were saying that this is actually pretty progressive for this part of the country, Pennsylvania. They're going to start giving financial assistance to medical cannabis patients, but only a certain segment of the patients, and that's the senior population.
Right, right. And there's a number of reasons for this. They're offering $50 a month in financial assistance to help about 1,400 senior citizens who are low income for the cost of medical cannabis. Now, like Lucas said, this is pretty progressive. I'm really a fan of this. I know it's not enough, but the article goes into some more detail, and you can go on the Pennsylvania Post-Gazette, and you can read a little bit about that. But basically, they don't have enough money in their fund to fund everyone who is in low income. But I did find this statistic interesting. There are 423,443 active patient certifications in Pennsylvania.
That's a lot.
And of that, 23%, or one out of every four cannabis patients in Pennsylvania, is considered low income. So if this program is allowed to expand and certain budgetary requirements are lifted, this could become a very interesting program existing in Pennsylvania, which is akin to like Medicaid funding prescriptions, except the state doing that for cannabis. This is very exciting if you're interested in cannabis being treated as a medicine by the state.
Yeah, it almost kind of seems like a little first step to start having insurance cover medical cannabis, which seems to be a long ways away. But I've heard it kind of rumbling around a little bit. I think I've heard Medicare kind of maybe say maybe, but that's going to be a long time. But this kind of seems like the state trying to help out. And I can't even imagine something like this happening in Washington. And it's really amazing. I could see something like this happening in Oregon. And I was just listening to one of our shows that was on the radio the other day. We were talking about up in Canada, they had the system where Canada helps the veterans.
Right.
And so this is kind of akin to that, and it would be really helpful to give some patients either free medical cannabis at the stores. That's what we've tried to get going here in Washington State. And actually, stores can give medical cannabis patients free cannabis.
Yes.
But you kind of have to know somebody. You got to get it through the processor or producer. I've tried to do it, and it's just it's hard to line it all up with the managers and everything. So it's very burdensome to actually get that going here in this state. But I could see something like this in California, Oregon, but it's really exciting that Pennsylvania's taking that first step.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and you know, that's one thing that actually Washington's a little bit better about than Oregon. Oregon doesn't allow compassionate, like, just free giving away. When I went the first year that weed was legal here in Oregon, on Veterans Day, a lot of local dispensaries were giving every veteran a free joint on Veterans Day. And so I drove around the first couple of legalization years picking up my free joint everywhere, and that was really fun. But that only lasted 2 years, and they cut that out. And now what a lot of stores are doing here in Oregon, and this is completely up to the individual retailer, right? This isn't something that everyone does or a state, but they'll sell like a certain marginalized group, whether it's veterans or low income people or whoever, a dollar bags of weed that are discounted or whatever. And that sometimes happens. But there's no, even in the law, way to do it from a retailer like there is in Washington. Whereas in Oregon, you can give each other all kinds of weed for free if you're not a retailer. Like, you can give one-time gifts to each other, you know, growers can trade weed and stuff like that, but there's no way in the license system for that to happen. If it's a medical grower to a patient or a medical patient to another patient, the law is a little different, if that makes sense.
And speaking of legalization, we're going to move over to our last story, and that is out of Oregon. And as we know, Oregon passed Prop 109, what was that, back in 2020, Dig?
Yeah, it was pretty recently. Yeah, I think it was back in 2020.
Yeah, but they've still been working on this, and that is to allow these psilocybin care centers. Now, they did not legalize psilocybin for recreational use in Oregon.
Right.
But they are trying to set up a system where you can go, similar right. to here in Washington, where you can go to ketamine treatments.
Right.
And so you can go and get treated for this. And they just had sort of a redo of Prop 109.
The conservatives here realized that Oregon had legalized mushrooms and that we had decriminalized small possession of certain drugs, and they lost their minds. Mm-hmm. And the Oregon Sheriff Association got involved, and they got a bunch of local and county amendments on local ballots to try to deny it. And a lot of local municipalities went ahead and banned it, but a lot of places also went ahead and allowed it. And what that does is that sets up like freeze, like areas where this is allowed in the state and areas which is or not. And I think the places who have disallowed it are going to find that it's a source of revenue they really wish they hadn't. But that's their problem.
Yeah, because a lot, like we were talking about your neck of the woods, some of the bigger cities did ban it, but some of the places out in the rural areas didn't ban it. And so it's sort of this mismatch. But the biggest cities, Portland, Eugene, Bend, Ashland, and I think a couple other larger cities did allow these psilocybin service centers. So yeah. That's really good news, and it's really incredible. I was telling Dig before the show, I'm going to try to do a radio documentary on one of these and go down to check them out. So stay tuned to the Cannabis Corner for that. And now for our guest, Gregory Foster, who is here to talk to us today about some things going on in Washington State and update us on some very important news going on in the state legislature this year. This episode of the Cannabis Corner is brought to you by Advocates for Medical Cannabis. Learn more about this organization at thecannabiscorner840.blogspot.com. And we are back on the Cannabis Corner for this week's guest. And this week, we are joined by a local cannabis activist, owner, and reporter over at the Cannabis Observer, Gregory Foster. And he is here today to talk to us about some things going on in the cannabis industry, and specifically what's been going on in Washington State and some upcoming things in the Washington State legislature. How is it going today, Gregory?
It's very good, and thank you, Lucas, for inviting me on the Cannabis Corner.
Yes, happy to have you on. I've been a fan of your work and Bailey's work for a long time over at the Cannabis Observer. And for those in our audience who are not familiar with the Cannabis Observer and what you guys do over there, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to work in the cannabis industry here in Washington State, and a little bit about the Cannabis Observer.
Sure. I've been in Washington State for the past 5 years and really immediately jumped into the cannabis sector and noticed that there was an absence of really good information about policymaking that was happening at the state level. And that was really the providence of Cannabis Observer. And we aim to create outstanding information about the policymaking that's going on, both at the Washington State Liquor and Cannabis Board, as well as the state legislature and other executive agencies that have a role in cannabis policymaking in the state. And so we go to, or now we can attend virtually, all of the public meetings of the Liquor and Cannabis Board. We make recordings of those. We gather together all of the meeting materials. We try to organize that into an easy-to-access form. And we write our own observations about what we hear and what we see, and publish that freely for everyone. And so we aim to raise the level of engagement in cannabis policymaking, get more people involved, because we think that'll result in better policymaking outcomes in the long run. And so we have certainly a lot of industry stakeholders who follow our work, as well as advocates and activists. We have public health people who subscribe to our work, as well as policymakers themselves. So it's been a very fun and interesting ride the last 5 years.
Yeah, and me, I can honestly say I've used the Cannabis Observer a couple times over at Gontrepreneurs to write articles about Washington State, because you guys really take a deep dive in exactly what's going on. And for folks that don't know, go over there and check out the Cannabis Observer. It's not only a cannabis lesson, but it's a really good civics lesson, because they really get down into the different meetings and how the government is interacting with the cannabis plant. And today I want to start with sort of a update on something that we have talked about on this show a fair amount, and that is social equity, and specifically the Social Equity and Cannabis Task Force going on here in Washington State. And just bring the audience up to date, those of you who don't know, social equity and social equity in cannabis is the idea and the fact that certain communities, people of color, Black, Indigenous, Asian, Mexican, Hawaiian, Pacific Islanders, and other people of color have disproportionately been affected by the drug war, and specifically the war on cannabis. And there is an effort to make sure that those people get into the industry and get their slice of the pie. And this is a nationwide and probably soon to be a worldwide movement. And Washington State has taken this thing head on. They had a couple pieces of legislation, and they started this Social Equity and Cannabis Task Force. And they are about to release their final recommendations, if I'm not mistaken. And tell us where that stands right now, and what is the future of the Social Equity and Cannabis Task Force here in Washington State?
Well, that's a really good summary of where that has been. Now, Washington State was a little bit late to the social equity movement. That's often framed as the fact that the Washington State created the first adult use market along with Colorado in 2012, or at least passed the citizen initiatives to do so. And so social equity wasn't really part of the conversation until the mid-2010s, I think. And so the first meeting of the task force was in October of 2020. And so they've been at work for over 2 years now, hosting public meetings, bringing together lots of stakeholders and different voices, community members, to talk about this very, very big and challenging subject. And so the task force itself is actually set to meet again here soon in early December to approve their final recommendations for in a legislative report that's due to the legislature on December 9th, and as well as the governor's office. And so it features a number of different recommendations that the group has come up with over the years. And so they're very close. My understanding is the task force itself, the enacting legislation for that task force expires in June of next year. So I'm not entirely certain this will be the last meeting of the task force coming up, but it's certainly the last meeting before kind of their required output of this legislative report.
Yeah, and Washington State was a little late to the party with the social equity. And for instance, Oakland and Sacramento and even Illinois are already rolling out dispensaries that are based on the idea of social equity. And some other states have a lot more funding. And Denver, they've done a really good job, like doing social equity cannabis delivery services and social clubs. So, you know, Washington State is coming along with this, and it's been a very interesting process to watch. I'm hoping that they renew the funding and bump that on up a little more. And I want to stick with the legislature, and this is a very interesting topic that we have also talked about on the Cannabis Corner a lot. That is these THC limit bills that have been popping up all over the country. I think the first one I ever saw was in Colorado, in Washington, and I've even seen some down in Florida that are already popping up. They just released this report by the Washington State Healthcare Authority, and they collaborated with University of Washington to release a report on high THC in cannabis. So fill us in a little bit about where that stands.
Sure. So it is a strange kind of phenomenon, but it's also kind of a complicated subject. And so here in Washington State, we have seen at the state legislature a number of different bills that have been put forward that have suggested putting what's called a potency cap, but this term potency itself is problematic. It's actually focused on the THC concentration within different products, so a certain percentage. And so there's been these THC concentration bills that have been put forward since 2019, as I recall. Those bills have been put forward by Representative Lauren Davis, who's out of the 32nd District, north of Seattle. And her background is she comes from the behavioral health kind of treatment industry. Was the sponsor of what's called Ricky's Law regarding involuntary treatment. And so she's also strangely been an advocate and put forward bills that have looked to decriminalize more drugs than just cannabis. But then there's this other aspect where she puts forward these potency cap bills. So it's kind of a complicated story that's unfolded at the state legislature, where you have this very popular champion of these bills. And I think that's one reason why they've gained a degree of traction in Washington State. So as a result of that work, it seems to me, there has been a work group was put together in 2019 based on a budget proviso that looked at whether taxing cannabis products based on the potency level or the THC concentration would be feasible. And I actually served on that LCB work group, and we were able to convince them that it was not feasible because we had just switched to a traceability provider, MJ Freeway, which proved problematic for the state. And there's inherent difficulties in terms of actually reliably testing for concentration levels in cannabis products. There's high variance amongst the labs, or there has been over the years, about actual accurate reporting and some cases of outright fraud. So we convinced them at that time that it was not feasible, right? But the bills kept on coming, and then there was a push to have the University of Washington alcohol drug or addictions drugs and alcohol institute, ADAI, who has traditionally done some work around what the state regards as education around cannabis products, as well as some connections to prevention research. And so this group was tasked with coming up with some reports and recommendations around the risks of high THC products. And here we're talking about different kinds of concentrates, typically. Like, while some of the research literature, the academic literature, refers to high THC as any product with more than 10% THC, so that would be inclusive of pretty much the majority of all flower that's sold in Washington State.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time nowadays, they're talking about products over 35%, and so flower is kind of excluded. But although you know, like infused joints would probably get caught up into that. So these researchers, and there's sort of like, this is another reason, it's sort of this, in my opinion, kind of this combination of, you have a strong state legislative sponsor as well as a pretty well-established research community. You know, it's sort of like the traditional kind of cannabis research that's federally funded to just look at harms.
Mm-hmm.
And these researchers have been active in that area for years and years, and kind of have a sort of research capture of the legislative attention and funding, although, you know, the funding that we actually give to any kind of research from the state is mediocre at best. So this community of researchers actually, on their own recognizance, put together what they called a consensus statement about the risks of high THC cannabis products. And this is everything from the risks of using cannabis during pregnancy to a frequent concern is acute cases or even lifetime cases of psychosis or psychotic disorders, which are not really very well described or explained or even looked into in some ways. Cannabis use disorder as a psychiatric evaluation or assessment that can be applied and seems to be applied to pretty much anybody who comes into the hospital that has been using cannabis. And so this group comes up with this consensus statement, this alarming collection of research that they themselves have been working on. And so that was put forward in 2021. And then this past year, those same researchers were tasked with surveying Washington State stakeholders about what they thought should be done about the risks of high THC products. And so they went through this elaborate process, interviewed, I think, on the order of 100 to 200 different people from different communities, including some cannabis stakeholders, although that was the smallest represented group, and tried to come up with some recommendations, and are now in the process of issuing this final legislative report that's due this month here in December. And we happen to get a hold of a copy of a draft of that report via public records request to the healthcare authority, and published that here in the last few weeks. in advance of a presentation to the House Commerce and Gaming Committee by the principal researcher on all of this. And so the legislative committee members admirably had quite a few questions for the researcher on that subject.
Yeah, that's good to hear that the committee is digging a little deeper into this, because I was approached to do the survey. I just wanted to say that the survey was not blind accessible. I wasn't able to do the survey. And I am a certified science teacher, and I just was reading it a little bit, and it was like, this is not written very well as far as not being biased. You could tell right off the first when you were reading the intro to it that it was really sort of slanted one way. And like you said, this group at UW, they are well-established scientists and researchers, so it's kind of hard to discount what they're saying. And I think they're kind of relying on that when they're taking them up here to the legislature. It was real interesting because I did hear on the news the other day, the radio, they opened up the report on this, talk about this report, to say the first thing out of the news reporter's mouth that according to this study or whatever they're putting out, that most of the time cannabis plants are 10% THC, like right off the stalk. And therefore, all these people are concentrating this stuff, and it's such a big, terrible thing for our community. Which, that right off the top, on the news that has been put out all across Washington State, is incorrect. So, do you think that this is going to gain a little more traction this year? I know it's been stopped, like you said, from 2019. But we are in some kind of crazy times where there's a lot of stuff on the news. I keep seeing this story about the kids over in Montana who were dabbing and got in some trouble and took too much THC. So there's like, and there's a lot of news stories with kids eating edibles. And I just saw one today. Edible poison control up 245% in the past decade. So there's like a little more of a snowball getting rolling downhill now. What do you think?
Well, I think that there's legitimate concerns. Like, people are getting themselves into situations where they have a little too much. They might get freaked out, and they might find themselves wanting to go to the hospital. And, you know, that's a thing that happens. It's my understanding. I don't know how much it happens. I don't know how much, like, I don't know how those folks are received at the hospital, right? Like, what? How are hospital staff trained to handle situations like that? Is that what we're hearing is people who are coming in with psychotic disorders, right? Like, is that what's going on there? So I think it's a legitimate concern, but I find it problematic, like you're saying, the way that these things are framed. You know, like, I myself have had circumstances where I've had a little too much, but I have experience. I have grounding. I have an understanding that these things too shall pass. Right. But if I were a kid, I were a younger man that had, these sorts of high THC products that were available, like, and maybe not as much health conscientiousness or awareness about the products, or didn't know what I was getting into, right? Like, you could find yourself in trouble. And so, but I don't know that that's a problem with the products themselves so much as people's education about the products or consumer awareness about the products. And, you know, to the credit of the people who are putting together those recommendations, they had to recognize that all of the stakeholders who they interviewed did agree that education and increasing consumer awareness around these things, or maybe even making modifications to the labels of the products or something like that, that was something everyone could agree on. Mm-hmm. However, the researchers still kind of leaned on the fact that they are the experts, right, on this, and said, you know, we still think it's worth exploring maybe raising the age limit to 25 to be able to purchase any of these products, or and, you know, just no real kind of awareness of any of the probable unintended consequences, or, you know, are they unintended consequences of implementing policies like that? Now, they did say, they did say that no one, well, not no one, they did say that there was not consensus that that a recommended policy should be a potency cap, right? They said that did not rise to the level of being in the go zone, so to speak, of their work. But they then added, you know, that may be worth coming back to in the future based on better consumer education about these products. It's like, God, you know, it's just troubling when, you know, these are, I know some of the researchers, I personally like them. I appreciate the conscientiousness with which they approach their work. But I have to just sort of wonder professionally about some of the choices that they've made, call into question their own credibility around these sorts of things. It's sort of sad.
Yeah. And I really appreciate that, outlook there. And I too have taken too much THC one time, and it is a very scary situation. It is, I think people get the misconception because they maybe have smoked a joint before that, okay, it's not going to be too much. But when you take it internally or a stronger version of THC, it's actually kind of shocking how strong it is, because you can really get in a place, like, I didn't call the hospital, but I, like you, I don't think if I had talked myself down, I might have called the hospital, because it really put me in a place where you're like, okay, what the heck's going on? So as we say on the Cannabis Corner plenty of times, and I'll repeat it here, please keep your cannabis out of the hands of kids and away from people that aren't supposed to be using it, pets, other adults. And if you you're yourself are a cannabis user, everybody that's using cannabis will tell you this, go slow, take it easy, because it can be a problem that you can take too much. So I feel like Gregory and I could go on about this topic, but we're going to move on to our next question. So you mentioned the traceability system earlier, and I first reported on that back in 2017. It actually went down on Halloween. That's a whole big thing. You can go over to Gontrepreneurs and follow. But they put in a new sort of traceability system. We had Jim McRae on here to talk about it a little bit. How is that going right now?
Well, that's another issue that I've been involved with. My background's computer science, and so I was thinking I would get involved with the data side of things when I first moved to Washington State. And Washington State at that time had an admirable policy of making publicly available an export on the monthly export from the BioTrack database. And like, all the data, like all the transaction level data about everything that's been going on within the regulated marketplace, all of the sales, all the wholesale sales, all the retail sales. So it's like just a treasure trove for folks who are of a data inclination. And I believe that has been like, it was the most transparent as far as other regulated marketplaces are concerned. And so they switched to Leaf Data Systems late 2017. All that data went away for about a year, but they then got it back on track and got it released again. And then, because MJ Free was such a abysmal software development company, really one of the worst, like regardless of what sector, it's one of the worst companies I've ever seen operating. They're owned by Akerna now and are not relied upon by very many states to run their traceability systems. I think maybe two or three at this point. And so we talked with the Liquor and Cannabis Board, got another work group together focused on, you know, what's next after MJ Freeway, because you guys need something other than MJ Freeway. And we talked with them for a good year, going through recommendations and ideas. And at the end of that year, the LCB came back and said, you know, we can't do another jump to another traceability provider, probably because they had been through them all. And instead, they were going to come up with their own in-house system called the Cannabis Central Reporting System. And they were going to ask licensees and their software integrators who provide the software to keep their operations running. They were going to ask them to upload CSV files, comma separated value files, which if you've been around since, I don't know, forever with computers, you know, that's a really old data format, and that most everybody has moved on to having some sort of an API, application programming interface, for a more real-time kind of interactions. But the LCB figured this is, you know, lowest common denominator. Everybody can do that. And so that's what we shifted to as of December of 2021. And so it's been in operation now for going on a year. And if you ask folks, and I know you asked Mr. McRae about this, if you ask folks who have looked at that data, they'll tell you that it is not the best, and that there are some issues, and that there's not even reporting by all licensees, and there's problems with getting the data to match up. So I don't know that we are in a better position now with regards to the data. However, to the credit of I think Washington State for being a little courageous and stepping out there on this, you know, if you look at other sectors, like even just compare the alcohol sector, you are not tracking where every single can of beer is.
True.
In Washington State, like there's no requirement to do that. It's just the cannabis sector where the states, and, you know, maybe for obvious reasons, beginning back in 2012, wanted to keep track of every single nug, or at least have the illusion of keeping track of every single nug and its transit around Washington State. And, you know, it's been a decade. There's been no federal pushback. And so we were successful in that regard, at least, in getting the state to say, you know, maybe we don't need to have this onerous reporting system, traceability system, that's a regulatory requirement, right? To be able to say that you're in compliance and keep your license, that you have to report all of this data to the state, which then becomes public record and that sort of thing. And instead, no, like, there's a lot of good value in that information. There's a lot of a lot of knowledge that can be gained from it. But that should maybe be more the prerogative of the operators to collect that kind of data and to use that data themselves and share it like they want. So I think all in all, the move to the CCRS approach is a good one, because it's kind of less onerous for the entire industry to meet those requirements. But the execution by the Liquor and Cannabis Board has been pretty poor, and it's put a lot of pressure on the software integrators in particular.
All right, so our next question is the one that I've been wanting to ask you, and it's the one that we talk about a lot. Our co-host Dig is a big home grower, and I'm someone who attempts to do it. Didn't have very good luck this year. But what do you think this year? Do you think this is the year the home grow bill gets passed? Because they've been getting really close.
I would sure love it. I am not entirely sure that there is a bill being put forward as of yet. However, the Social Equity and Cannabis Task Force has that as one of their recommendations, that from an equity perspective, the state should go ahead and legalize home grow, so we can regard ourselves as, you know, actually legitimately supporting the cannabis plant. And I think there's a definite argument to be made from an equity perspective that, just like we've seen with regards to disproportionate enforcement around cannabis possession in general, The same is true, apparently, with regards to raids on home grows. That's also been disproportionately impacted certain communities over others. So I do hope it does move forward this session.
All right. Well, you know, we do, too, hope the home grow bill passes, because I would like to start getting all my neighbors start growing cannabis and get some more legal home grow cannabis here in South Tacoma. It'd really be great that we could kind of exchange cannabis like we do our tomatoes and pumpkins and everything, and it could truly be legal. And it's really nice to hear the Social Equity and Cannabis Task Force put that out there as one of the recommendations. And we are going to get out of here. And before we do, just give us your website real quick, and where can people get in touch with you if they want to hear more about the Cannabis Observer?
You can find us on the web at cannabis.observer, and we're on social channels at CanObserve, so CanObserv. And so you can find us there on Facebook, on LinkedIn, on Twitter, on Instagram. And thank you so much for having me on the show, Lucas, and thank you for all the work that you do as well.
Thank you. This episode of the Cannabis Corner is brought to you by Advocates for Medical Cannabis. Learn more about this organization at thecannabiscorner840.blogspot.com. We are back with our final segment, and that is our It's a Bust segment. In this part of the show, we look at the drug war and the war on cannabis and update the audience on what is going on in that. And this one is an interesting story. It comes out of Ohio and then later Pennsylvania. They ended up finding some very large amounts of cannabis stuffed into the spare tire wheel well of some brand new Ford Focuses, not used, like brand new, straight from the factory, sent by rail from Mexico, were packed full of weed. Dig.
Yeah, that's small correction. That's a Ford Fusion. No big deal.
Oh,
but yeah, they figured it out. A dealership in Ohio found a bunch of weed in their cars. They just got off the semi truck and called the police, and it's very interesting, and this kind of, and they don't really know why the packages of weed were in there, or like how they got to the dealership. And this almost reminds me of a story that came out of, I believe, DC, someplace back east years ago, where people were mailing packages of pot to people and then picking them up before the people noticed, and a local mayor got arrested and charged and stuff, and then they found out that it wasn't even his weed that got mailed to his house. People were picking random addresses and getting weed mailed there and then picking it up and selling it on the street. So
yeah,
that's interesting.
Yeah,
so that's what this reminds me of.
Yeah, it could have been like somebody trying to send a bunch of Ford Focuses Fusions up there, and then somehow some people come in and buy those cars with the cannabis in it. Now, that really seems like a very difficult operation, but who knows?
Or someone at the dealership was trying to pull the packages out before boss noticed.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking. Or they got they got put on the wrong shipment. I mean, who knows? But it's just another example. I mean, it's just, we have legal cannabis. Ohio has medical cannabis. There's cannabis all around Ohio. We were just talking about Pennsylvania. But yet they're still shipping big amounts of cannabis up from Mexico. It's time that we move on past this war on drugs. And this has just been going on forever. And it just seems like it's not going to stop. And who knows how many they didn't catch. And that somebody did get their hands on that and where it went. So a very interesting story out of Ohio. I would like to thank our guest, Gregory Foster, for being on the show today, and I'd like to thank the audience and everybody listening, and I'd like to thank you, Dig, for being with me today.
Oh, yeah, it was a pleasure. Thanks, everyone, so much for listening.
If you have questions or would like to comment on the show, you can reach us at thecannabiscorner840@gmail.com. To listen to back episodes or to subscribe to the show, find us all across the internet by searching The Cannabis Corner. How can folks get in touch with you, Dig?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram at Uncle Dig, and you can listen to my podcast, The Bagseed Chronicles, wherever you get podcasts.
Thank you to Radio Tacoma and KTQA for their continued support. I'd also like to thank Aaron Folsch for his production assistance. And finally, thank you for joining us on The Cannabis Corner.